thank you, gentlemen. The eternal battle for the domination of the world begins. Random target selection, Spain. Value $9,000. Spain.
Do come in, 007. And listeners, park yourself up with a vodka martini, make yourself comfortable. Now, before we start, we're going to have to get you to sign a document saying the greatest oral rapture of your life was afforded to you on a boat in Nassau by the Oddjob Pod. Well, that probably won't be necessary, but there may be some gratuitous sex and violence in the pod. It's been a bit dull around here. In case you haven't have guessed, after an epic journey through villainry, we thought we'd take a little side journey in a Citroen 2CV, naturally, via one of the most overlooked Bond films, Never Say Never Again. And joining me to say never again, like Sean Connery did several times, are Graham Sibley and Terry DeFellin. How are you, gents?
Very good, thank you very much, Gary.
All the richer for that spectacular intro, Gary.
Yes, you can tell that I've been watching this film a few times over the last week in the anticipation of this podcast. Yes, so we are going to be talking Never Say Never Again. The slight one-off, the Bond film that's not a Bond film, but is a Bond film, but depends what your definition of a Bond film is. So, I mean, I guess the first obvious question, gents, is, is it a Bond film?
Yes, it is. It's totally a Bond film. That's my opinion, anyway. If you'd asked me that 15 years ago, I'd have said absolutely not. But since the Craig reboot, you can say, yeah, this is totally a Bond film. If Casino Royale is a Bond film, then this is totally a Bond film as well.
I mean, everything about it is Bond, but the only thing about it really is that it's kind of, it's not canon, it's kind of semi-canon, side canon, I don't quite know what you call it. But it fits within Bond, but it isn't Bond because it's not official, it's bootleg Bond.
If you wanted to be unkind, and I'm not going to be unkind about this movie at all, but if you wanted to be unkind, you'd say it was fan fiction. But I think side canon is a good one, because the thing about Never Say Never Again, it's based upon Thunderball. That's the whole reason why this movie ended up getting made, because of the ownership rights for Thunderball. So it's starring Sean Connery as James Bond. So it is an authentic James Bond story. It just isn't an official James Bond film. That's all. It doesn't have, it's not made by Eon. It doesn't come with the usual characteristics typical of a James Bond film. It hasn't got a Morris Binder title sequence, a gun barrel sequence. It didn't have a John Barry soundtrack, which at the time would have been inauthentic in that respect. But in many, many respects, this is an authentic James Bond film, and I think should be included as such. But obviously, if you observe canon, then of course it shouldn't be included within canon, because it's not an Eon production.
So, Graham, you know, it has a level of, I mean, there's so much to unpick, and I know we're going to get across this in the next 45 minutes or so. But how much actual authenticity can you actually taste within in that film? Or is it, as Terry said, like a bit of fan fiction, like Sebastian Faulks having a good crack at writing a Bond novel?
I think that's a very good analogy, because obviously with Connery there, that gives it credibility, doesn't it? Instantly.
Yes.
Mm. And of course, you know, the especially the London scenes and the exotic locations all look very, very Bond. But of course, yeah, it's the production design that makes it feel slightly different. It could be any mid-80s action film in some respects. I remember seeing years ago, someone actually took the music from David Arnold's music from the opening sequence to Tomorrow Never Dies and put it over the training sequence at the start of Never Say Never Again. And instantly, it looked far more authentic. It looked like a proper Bond film straight away, just because of the music there. And I'm sure Terry's going to go on about the music at length
I'll
later.
I'll try not to.
But no, of course,
it's a finished subject.
I was going to say, with actually the music, there's so much I like about the film, but if we're going to start off and get into put our cards on the table, lay everything out that we don't like, the score is probably, for me, one of the worst Bond scores that's ever been made.
Yeah.
And it's so deliberately non-Bond, isn't it?
But they went with Michel Legrand, who's a wonderful French composer, a veteran French composer, and a jazz composer. And I think that that's what they've made a deliberate creative choice, thinking we're upsetting Eon enough as it is by making this movie. So if we try to copy aspects of it, you know, then we could find ourselves with lawsuits afterwards, because I imagine that Eon's lawyers will be looking through there saying, that's us, that actually belongs to us. So the music would have been a big feature of that. So I think even with the introduction, the 007s on the screen going up and finally going into one single zero, I think even that was pushing it a little bit, because that could be saying, well, that's actually inspired by the gun barrel sequence, so we're going to sue you.
Yeah.
So I suspect that choice was made by the music, and it's a shame, because also there are a limited number of cues. A lot of the cues get repeated throughout the movies, which was not uncommon for an 80s film.
Yeah.
And that adds to its disappointment. And I think that although this film is an extremely well-made 1980s action film, it's dated as such. Whereas I would perhaps argue that, you know, contemporary, like Octopussy, it's contemporary in terms of production values, perhaps hasn't dated so badly.
Yeah.
I mean, Octopussy is an interesting one, because obviously they were both released in the same year. And from what I know, Never Say Never Again, I think, had a better opening weekend than Octopussy did, but Octopussy grossed higher overall. And it's a fascinating contrast for me, Graham, because you've kind of got this one film which, yes, it's an 80s action movie on one hand, but there's also an awful lot that's obviously calling back to the 60s, because that's when the original script and story is written, and a lot of the cinematography almost feels like it could have been lifted a bit from there. And then on the other hand, you've got Octopussy, which is, I don't think, could have been made at any time other than the 80s, and is almost a complete and utter, they're two very totally different films. And by putting the two of them side by side, it must have been fascinating at the time, having both a kind of Connery and a Moore film come out at the same time with the same character, and looking at the contrast and compare between the two of them.
I was a teenager. Well, we both were teenagers when this came out. I think the other big film of the summer, I think, was Jaws 3D, I think. I remember the hullabaloo there was of having two James Bond films come out in the summer, and everyone was going, oh yeah, but the real James Bond is in this one.
Never Say Never Again.
Yeah,
because Sean. Yeah,
yeah.
Because even in the 1980s, many people still considered Sean Connery to be the original James Bond.
Yeah,
many people felt that Roger Moore was a pretender.
Yeah,
and no matter how good he was. Of an older generation, us teenagers, not so much, because we cut our teeth on our James Bond was Roger Moore.
Exactly, yeah.
And in the same way, younger Bond fans have like Pierce, and they'll have Daniel, or perhaps even Tim.
Yeah.
Ours was Roger, and so I didn't feel that sort of like issue at all. Although obviously I knew Sean Connery was probably arguably the better actor. But I think I've even revised that opinion over time. But
yeah, I think we're of a narrow generation whereby for us, Roger Moore was the James Bond you saw at the pictures. Sean Connery was the James Bond you saw on
on ITV. Yeah, absolutely. You taped Sean Connery movies off the telly.
Yeah.
And then you went to the pictures to go and see James Bond Roger Moore films.
Yeah.
So in that respect, there was a great, it was extremely novel experience going to see and Never Say Never Again. And I really enjoyed going to see it. I think I went to see it numerous occasions. I'm sure I went with you at least once. I know I went with our mutual friend Martin a number of times to go and see that film. But it is probably worth stressing that in the 1980s, when you didn't have sell through VHS, you certainly didn't have DVD and digital, you know, if you wanted to go and you wanted to see a movie again, you would have to just go back to the theatre and watch it again.
And
cinemas were cheaper back then, so you could go in, you know, and I'm certain that I saw that film with the pictures at least three times. So, and similarly with Octopussy, in fairness, when that came out as well, because this is my mid-teens you know, I this is probably catching my Bond fandom at its most febrile. So this movie's quite emotional for me. It was quite an emotional experience rewatching it for the first time in years and reminding myself actually how much I really, really like this film. And I think over the years I've become a bit dismissive of it, and I've enjoyed the opportunity to watch it again with a little bit more of an objective view, and still think actually, despite its flaws, this is actually still a pretty cracking and, I would say, authentic James Bond movie.
Which is the better film? Never Say Never Again or Octopussy? If we were putting it into Bond's, you know, I'm sure we all know where we rank, and we all know that I'm probably wrong on Moonraker, as I'm told numerous times on here, but where does it, you know, these are two good films. I mean, I love Octopussy. It's one of my favourite Moore films. Thunderball was not necessarily one of my favourite Connery films, but I quite like Never Say Never Again. I'd find it quite hard to pick which one. If you ask me which one I'd rather sit down in an evening and watch, you'd probably have to get which mood I'm in, really.
Oh, it's totally that. I mean, the only way you can ever ask that question is if someone puts two DVD boxes in front of you and say, what do you want to watch now?
Yeah. But again, as Gary points out, that does depend on what kind of frame of mind you're in. My feelings about Octopussy's aesthetic is still very much, I'm not sure that Ken Adam did this one. I think it might have been his last, or no, I think he actually had gone by then, but that aesthetic was still heavily informing the James Bond movies. And there's a tonally and the colour palette of that movie. And I think also the cinematography just mellows the tone of these, of the visual tone of the movie, if visual tone is indeed a thing, just slightly. It feels not darker in terms of its story, far from it, but just a much cooler film to watch.
Whereas, well, the whole setting large chunks of it in India helps with the colour palette of the film.
Yes,
and it does make it gives exactly. it a vibrancy.
But it's also set in Western Europe as well.
Yeah,
so you can't have that kind of clash of East Germany, London, and then India. You know, and it can clash. So it's got to have a much more consistent sort of like palette to it. Whereas Never Say Never Again doesn't really have that problem, because most of the time it's set either in the Bahamas or in Southern Europe. So it can look nice and bright and technicolory. That's the most striking element between those two movies, is just how they look. In terms of which one is better, well, I would say Never Again is less racist than Octopussy. So I think that if you were saying to somebody who had never seen these two movies before which one is better, you probably would better off saying Never Say Never Again. It is also, however, worth bearing in mind, just think about Never Say Never Again's lineup.
Yeah.
That cast of characters that is in there is phenomenal. I mean, Edward Fox, Barbara Carrera, Klaus Maria Brandauer, Kim Basinger, you know, Max von Sydow, you know, Bernie Casey, you know, I mean, these are all fine actors. And the filmmaker, I mean, Irving Kirshner, this is the guy who made Empire Strikes Back, you know, arguably one of the best directors ever to direct a James Bond film. There's quality in this movie. It falls down because of its ambition. Its action sequences are too ambitious. But this is not necessarily a criticism, because this is a symptom of a lot of films from that era. They're getting their head round special effects.
Yeah.
And they know, we can do this. We can do a horse jumping off at the edge of a castle. It looks awful, but we can do it. So let's do it.
So do you think then that Warhead 2000 would have been a much better film? Do you think they would have got it right by that stage? Or do you think they would have got the worst CGI effects because they could do it?
I think that they would have made the Escape from LA mistake, which is, we have CGI, let's use it. Yeah, but we don't have anyone who knows how to use it. Doesn't matter.
I want
a helicopter with folding rotor blades. Give it to me now. But it looks awful. I don't care. Put it in.
I think that is what we're going to come back to, I think, in this conversation about the relative quality of Never Say Never Again, is the fact that it's a remake of a pretty average Bond film. Although it's genre-defining, I think, Thunderball.
Yeah.
It's one of the three films, I think, that whenever you're going to do a parody of Bond, you have to refer back to.
Well, I mean, and here comes our obligatory reference to Austin Powers.
Yeah.
I mean, Thunderball you know, Austin Powers borrows very heavily from Thunderball.
And I think that's one of the main problems with it, is the fact that Bond always sails dangerously close to self-parody anyway, and many people would say it exists in parody. But when you've got one of the films that's been parodied most and you're trying to remake it, you're going to have to constantly battle to rein it in, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's such a fascinating film to watch, because you look at the two films and you put them side by side, but then you also look at the cast as well, and you know, the cast of Thunderball are no slouches. But I think, you know, on paper, I mean, and to take a football analogy here, if you put those two casters down on paper, you'd look at Never Say Never Again and go, lads, we're probably in for a bit of a bit of a ride here. Although I'd like to point out, I don't know if I'm the only person who, when you know, you watch M come on, played by Edward Fox, and you're going, Sean Connery, don't take orders from him. He's going to assassinate the President of France. What are you doing?
Come on, if Bond had been asked to do it, he wouldn't have asked any questions, would he?
No, certainly not. Certainly not. The President of France, no. I thought, Gary, that you were, but probably might have been tickled to have seen Edward Fox, given how much we know you adore, rightly adore, Day of the Jackal.
It's a fantastic film. It really is. You know, well, I could do an entire podcast happily on Day of the Jackal if I wanted to. And also, Edward Fox is just a fantastic actor as well. Also, funnily enough, my wife's first encounter with Day of the Jackal was actually the Bruce Willis remake.
Oh, my word.
I've not actually seen that, in fairness.
You don't have to. Unless you're feeling a moment where you really hate yourself, then waste 2 hours of your life.
But Eddie Fox is superb as M, I think. I mean, he's a very different character. I mean, the original M is public school, university educated. He's, because he was conceived in post-war UK, he is a grizzled ex-naval commander, carrying the burdens of war. And that informs the character as Bernard Lee played him, I think. Whereas Never Say Never Again, he has, I think, the humour that goes with the Bond film nicely. Yeah. But he's more in keeping in terms of character with, say, a Robert Ludlum or a John le Carré kind of civil servant.
And very much like the character when Judi Dench was introduced in GoldenEye.
Very much so, absolutely. And, of course, as we know, Judi Dench thawed over the course of the film.
And became more like...
And became an advocate, and indeed started making the same kind of mistakes that the Blunt Instrument makes. Whereas Edward Fox is far more reined in, doesn't like the 00 section, doesn't hold with it, but it obviously presented with this sort of like apocalyptic situation which requires, and this is exactly why the 00 section is quite good. The movie does quite a good job in conveying the necessity of having a 00 section because of ludicrous and frankly unrealistic situations like this. But I mean, for the purposes of telling the story, it justifies the existence of the character within the story. Because
so in many ways, it explores the world of Bond more than most Bond films do.
Yeah, well, it does. It definitely takes a look at the whole thing.
Yeah.
I mean, you can get that also with the scene with Algernon as well, which was a lot of fun. Alec McCown, again, superb interpretation of the character.
Yeah.
Different.
Oh, yeah,
again,
certainly.
Probably said, look, we need to be different in these respects. You could argue that this takes away from the authenticity of it as a Bond film, but it adds a great deal of richness. And the idea that the film exists to a certain extent, it's got a touchstone with the real world, because, you know, it's the 1980s, it's Thatcherism, there's cutbacks, it's the Tories are in control, they're cutting back government departments because that's what Tories do, and, you know, Her Majesty's Secret Service is no exception. And he's talking about how he would love to get a job at the CIA, and he'd go there in a heartbeat, because they've got funding, you know, and air conditioned offices and stuff like that. The stuff that doesn't play havoc with his sinuses. But it just gives us it's a nice sort of like nice touchstone with reality, which the official Bond movies probably at that era anyway just didn't do. You know, I mean, you not contrast that with Octopussy, where, you know, Q's got his own lab.
I wonder if Gary, do you think that the analysis of the whole 00 section and Q, whether or not that encouraged Eon to develop Q in around that mid-80s time as well, because he gets quite a substantial role in Octopussy.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's actually a lot that you can take from that film. And again, the more I was watching it, the more I went, actually, you can see little strands which hadn't really appeared in the Moore era films,
yeah,
but are starting to be picked up again in Dalton, Brosnan, and especially Craig. And
yeah,
actually, it was really fascinating watching Never Say Never Again, when you see, I've seen a lot of Craig films, because Craig's films are so self-referential and set themselves up and explore Bond in a similar way, but they're very knowing, whereas this one almost feels there's a bit more deconstruction, there's a bit more thought in, but a lot of the seeds that were planted in Never Say Never Again do kind of recur throughout the Brosnan and Craig eras, which I found absolutely fascinating that, and I hadn't really picked up on at the time, but it was only looking with a little bit more depth in it that we got to that stage and you went, you know what? I wonder how much they would have been prepared to go down that route, and I think they probably still would have done, had Never Say Never Again not existed, because that's a film that has just explored Bond so thoroughly inside and out, and it has to be very knowing, but as Terry's already pointed out, skates on the legal lines, that it ends up being almost a kind of meta-analysis of Bond in itself.
Yeah, totally. I think it as what I said at the top of the pod about the fact that if you'd asked me 15 years ago, was this part of canon, I'd say no. And now, after the Daniel Craig films, you think, well, actually, they've taken so much, or they've analysed the same things in those films. I wouldn't say they've stolen them, because we don't need any more legal problems with these. But yeah, certainly in the portrayal of what the 00 section is about, it is that analysis. And also as well, it's because the Craig era Bond was a reboot, and so there is no timeline anymore. There is no sequence of the Bond films. So canon really does go out the window, doesn't it?
I mean, I think the discussions of canon for me should be restricted to Casino Royale and afterwards, because that's when the franchise was rebooted,
yeah,
and that's when a story arc was introduced. So each film became a sequel to the one before, whereas beforehand, really, they were not. They were an anthology series, and they, with a few exceptions, they pressed the reset button. There's not much history to the character of James Bond, with perhaps the exception of Tracy and Blofeld. So I think that you made the point, actually, before we started recording, that you felt that Casino Royale owes quite a great deal to Never Say Never Again, because it provided a bit of a framework for them to reboot the franchise, because that's what Never Say Never Again could be described as. It could be described as a reboot of the franchise.
Yeah, and it gives that, it almost gives them permission to reboot. And they had a sort of reboot with GoldenEye. It fell short. Obviously, they brought in a lot of new cast members for GoldenEye. New Moneypenny, new M. Same old Q. So you've still got a few of the bits there still around there. But whenever you're trying to develop the franchise and you're trying to keep things, a lot of the cues that say, for want of a better word, that tell you that you're watching a Bond film. So GoldenEye does start with the gun barrel sequence. Casino Royale goes that step forward and says, no, we're going to move the gun barrel sequence right to the end.
Mm. It's interesting that they felt that they had that kind of freedom to be able to say, well, actually, we're going to go off-piste a bit. With the format a little bit, because we're going to do this. And Never Say Never Again happened, and that made a pot of money. So if they can do it, then we can do it.
Going back into the cast, because we almost kind of skirted over that because there's so much to talk about. But how good is the cast in Never Say Never Again? I mean, you look at some of the performances in there, and you could put those into any official Bond film, and we would probably be raving about some of them.
I think if you take that cast and put it into an official James Bond film, then you've got one of the best James Bond films ever. I don't think there's a poorly cast member of that lineup, with the possible exception, and this is utterly a matter of taste, but with the possible exception of Rowan Atkinson,
Johnny English.
I think at the time, this is worth stressing, Rowan Atkinson was still very much part of the 1980s alternative comedy set. this is the guy who played Blackadder, this is the guy who was in Not the 9 o'clock News, and his contemporaries were very much those, that alternative comedy scene. For him to arrive in this movie was quite a statement, I think. Obviously, clearly a statement for the actor, for Rowan Atkinson himself, who clearly thought, I want to be an actor and not a comedian. And obviously then went on to have a distinguished career, which may colour his appearance in this movie. But, I mean, you've also... I mean, you've got Kim Basinger, who comes in... This is at the beginning of her career, yes, to a very large degree. Arguably, this is her breakthrough film.
Yeah, 5 years before Batman, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. And she is sensational in this movie. I mean, both the girls are. But, I mean, certainly Barbara Carrera,
yeah,
and Kim Basinger, they are a vital component as to why this movie is so watchable and so fun.
So we've skirted it around a bit, and I just had a sudden thought there, sorry, before I come on to the next thing of Terry mentioning where Rowan Atkinson had come from. Do you think you could have had Ben Elton having a cameo instead in there?
yeah. Let's not go down that rabbit hole. Could I also just add quickly, in case we don't get to mention this, but I have to also give props to classic 80s tough guy Pat Roach,
who's
in this film as well. Indiana Jones. I'm a big fan of the Indiana Jones movies as well, and Pat Roach turns up as generic thug. He plays a Nazi who ends up meeting a sticky end in Raiders of the Lost Ark with the big fist fight. And then he has a similar fist fight as a genuine thuggy, yeah. albeit blacked up.
It was the 80s.
it was the 80s. And for him to make an appearance in this movie, I think just like gives it some real sort of like 80s class. Yeah. This is a movie that I think that our friend Rich Nelson at Betamax Video Club would go to town with when he gets around to it.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And one of those reasons, I'm sure, will be Pat Roach. There'll be about 20 minutes devoted just to Pat Roach
section. Yeah. Mind you, he was so ubiquitous in the 80s, as you've described. I mean, I'm surprised he doesn't turn up every week on that podcast.
Well, I like the idea of Rich Nelson having a spin-off podcast that's just focusing on Pat Roach and Pat Roach movies. I feel that's niche and that's a podcast that the world deserves to hear.
Yeah, maybe he'll stick it on his Patreon or something like that. But it's not the heavyweights. We talked about Edward Fox and we talked about and Klaus Maria Brandauer as Largo. Mm. I mean, like, you compare him against although there's only 20 years between these movies, which actually isn't that long ago, but I mean, it's an age in terms of popular culture. Klaus Maria Brandauer is far more, he reminds me much more of a kind of modern villain. I mean, he almost seems like one of those sort of like professional CEOs that you started to see emerging in that time, who were very, very touchy-feely, really, like they'd pat you on the back and ask you how you're getting on, you know. I mean, like, you know, don't worry, you know, your wife and kids are fine down in the hold, you know, they're being well-fed, but you're all right, are you, yeah? How are those results coming? That kind of thing. He strikes me as being that kind of guy, and he was a complete nutter as well.
Yeah, but it does lead into that whole sort of like coke-fueled villain that you see throughout the 80s.
Yeah. Absolutely.
This comes out the same year as Scarface, doesn't it?
I don't know. That's
I think
a
it
great
does.
Question.
I think this does.
Yeah.
I think this goes right up against Scarface, and Scarface obviously clears the board as far as like everyone else is concerned. But I think that also affects the way that Bond films are made as well, because they look at something like that and take cues from just there.
Christopher Walken, really, isn't it? Is the natural conclusion of all that. Yes. That's where that led to.
Klaus Maria Brandauer just does a superb job with Max Largo.
Yeah.
I think he's excellent. One of the problems with the story of Thunderball, and indeed Never Say Never Again, is this cat and mouse game between Bond and Largo. The fact that they both know who each other are and they both know why they're there. And the kind of thing, why don't you just put a bullet in his head kind of thing?
Yeah.
You know, why are you playing games with him? And you know, he tries to kill him and still invites him to lunch. Whereas I think that in Never Say Never Again, Brandauer does, and indeed Connery, do a much better job in, you know, establishing that there's a reason why they're playing this cat and mouse, is that there's something personal for Brandauer. He sees Bond as a threat, trying to steal his girl, trying to be better than him. He wants to beat him. And that's why, although it is a peculiar scene, the video game scene
is
pivotal in that, because... I mean, I have no idea how modern audiences are going to look at that game and see how it works. I really don't know. I suspect, sadly, that to a modern aesthetic, that would just look ridiculous. But that scene serves the rest of the film extremely well, because you've got the competition between the two. It's a duel. And you've also got huge amounts of pain going on. You've got the intervention of Domino and the development of the hatred between these two people. That's now personal and allows us to understand how Largo doesn't just put a bullet in James Bond's head and be done with it, which is probably the most sensible thing that he should have done. And I think it sets that film up nicely. And I think that it was a very, very important scene in that. It's just, but again, I stress, for modern audiences, if they see that, that could just fall to pieces. And then I suspect the rest of the movie falls apart as well.
Yeah, mid-80s obviously is the time when Atari's are just coming out.
Yes.
So home video games and in video game arcades are just suddenly becoming fashionable and something of interest and also something worrying as well.
Yeah.
If you're a tabloid journalist.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the fact that you've got films like Tron coming out that try to harness that, but any other time a film tries to get into that sort of zeitgeist, they fail miserably. I think I remember reminded of the scene in Pure Eyes Only when they're doing the facial recognition thing.
Oh God, yeah, that's terrible. Yeah, yeah, that's ill-conceived, isn't it?
Yeah,
absolutely. I think that the game scene in Never Say Never Again is helped because of the set.
Mm.
That whole sequence, in fact, at the casino is it's a beautiful set. It looks a lot more of a Bondian set up there. I thought that they did that very well. And I love the bit with the heavy where he convinces him that he's got a bomb in his cigar, in his cigarette case. And that whole sequence, I think, works extremely well. And I thought Sean was really comfortable in those scenes and was giving his best Bond there and then.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, that is one aspect of it as well, because he's not dialing it in like in Diamonds Are Forever.
But I mean, that's a good point, because that's the thing, because arguably he's dialing it in from You Only Live Twice. I mean, people don't like him in You Only Live Twice.
Yeah.
And so really you could say that the only films he's really, really worked hard on were the first four and Never Say Never Again, which he really did put in a real shift in there. And he's really, really good. I mean, he's very, very convincing.
And arguably it reignites his career.
Yeah, because he goes on and does
Untouchables,
and that detective where he's a monk.
Name of the Rose. Yeah,
yeah, and of course, Hunt for Red October.
Hunt for Red October. Yes.
Also, a film I would put up there with Day of the Jackal.
Definitely.
A film that is just phenomenal.
When we do a Patreon, what we'll do is we'll do these movies.
Yeah.
But you realise, of course, that means we're never going to do these movies.
We didn't mention, of course, his last outing as, in inverted commas, James Bond, which was obviously The Rock.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, no, yes.
As we've already proved
on this podcast. Already established that The Rock is a James Bond film.
Yes.
We should do a director's commentary on The Rock one day, just for the hell of it.
Yep.
Or not director, pod commentary on The Rock when I'm back in England.
Man alive, that would be brutal. We are totally doing that.
Before we go on to the big question, one other thing that I just wanted to pick up on this film, which I really liked and you know, it's peppered throughout, is that they actually make no bones about just how old Bond is in this film as well. Connery was, I think, 52. Moore was 53 and rocking out a safari suit and then, let's be fair, really kind of creaking his way through A View to a Kill a few years later. But I found it fascinating. Just, again, we talked about how knowing the Craig films are. This is a film that knows that the level of absurdity of having a kind of a superhero who is, you know, probably starting to think about where he's put his pension fund.
Yeah, totally. I think it's something that they've been brave enough to address in more recent films as well. The fact that Never Say Never Again could exist was a symptom of the timidity of Eon, about how they weren't brave enough to make big changes, and why they held on to Roger Moore for so long. And yes, they could say, "Oh well, we were waiting for Pierce Brosnan." But that really isn't an excuse. I mean, they obviously felt like they got burnt with Lazenby, and they were afraid. I suppose they were they were afraid of making a change, of changing things, changing a winning formula, which I suppose happens for a lot of people.
Do you think, chaps, that Roger stayed on longer because of Never Say Never Again, because they thought that the franchise was vulnerable at this point, because there was a possibility, and that they thought rather than make a change, the change might not work, like it didn't work with George, and that they were better off just with a safe pair of hands while they kind of rode out this storm, this new wave of action movies coming out. You've got a new James Bond or an old James Bond coming back, a rival franchise possibly emerging, thinking, is this the moment to start making changes? Do you think that maybe that's one of the reasons why they decided to stick with Roger? Or do you think it's just because Cubby just liked having his backgammon partner around?
Probably a lot to do with that. He liked a lot of cigars. I think, as Gary said, this film made more money. Octopussy made more money than Never Say Never Again. It could have come down to that. They could have said, well, it still works. Why gamble that on getting Jason Connery in?
Or Michael Praed.
Or all those other names that were
knocking
about. Ian Ogilvy, all these names.
Anthony Andrews. Yeah.
I wonder if Edward Fox. Well, Edward Fox must have been on the list at some point.
Edward Fox was. Did we not talk about him in our non-Bond podcast? Did we not mention?
I believe he made an appearance in the four non-Bond.
You were in the Gary podcast, naturally. I mean, as a blonde actor, of course, he might have encountered the same difficulties that Craig had, although I doubt it.
Yeah.
Because obviously, remember craigs.bond.com?
It's still there. It's still there.
Guys.
Yes.
He's leaving. He's on notice. Relax.
No, now they're worried that he's still going to be around for the next film after this.
He could be
one.
M.
Oh, wow.
He could be M.
Yeah.
In the next franchise.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who knows?
Who knows?
Who knows? So anyway, sorry. We got... I'm surprised that we got sidetracked while having one of these conversations. It never happens.
I am shocked beyond belief. So we've skirted around the issue quite a lot, but we've got to ask questions. So I'll come to you, Terry, first. Where does this stand up versus Thunderball? Given that it's pretty much by all. There's a lot that bits that are different, but essentially it's the same story. It's a remake. And some remakes are better than the original. Some, like the bizarre decision to remake Psycho, shot put in color, are definitely not better than the original. Where does this one stand? Is it a Psycho or is it an Ocean's 11?
I think that this movie is more watchable than Thunderball. It's got a much better pace. It still suffers from the same problems that Thunderball has, in that its climax is set underwater, and that's not a satisfactory climax for me. But I think that it's in many ways a more skillfully made film. Irving Kirshner's the director. It's written by Lorenzo Semple Jr. That's the teleplay. He's the guy who gave us Flash Gordon, by the way, and the Batman 66 movie as well. It's got a great cast, and it's a really good, well-made film for its time. Thunderball, on the other hand, is lavish. I mean, it's got a lavish budget. It's got those gorgeous, gorgeous Ken Adams sets going for it. It has got Sean in its peak. It's got fantastic, Fiona Volpe. In it, for me, the film is 10 minutes too long, and it's got for all the money it spent, some of its action sequences are pretty ropey. I mean, the undercranking on the end of Thunderball really does check you out. Not that doesn't happen in Never Say Never Again, by the way, because the bike chase in there, although a very ambitious chase in many ways. You could see where the budget was really being stretched because that sequence. So if I had to watch one or t'other, it would probably, not 4 out of 5 times, be Never Say Never Again.
Yeah. If Never Say Never Again was the start of a new Bond franchise, 2 or 3 films in, they would have got it down pat. And,
yeah.
And that, but obviously you don't get two or three films.
I
think there were things there that, because they wanted to try and throw the kitchen sink and get everything in there, that obviously when that, it, either it sticks or it all just looks like a big, big mess.
Mm.
I think it's a very, very good attempt. But as I say, I don't rate Thunderball that much as a film anyway, because some of the action sequences are so protracted. And, and yeah, and this film falls into the same trap of there's always a loaded harpoon gun around when you want one.
Just when you need one. Yeah, it's a bit Nightboat, isn't it? Oh, there's a handy, look, Michael, there's a fjord we can go down. I mean, it is very convenient. And these are the problems with the story in general, and they are never going to go away. So, but I mean, I think that they made an amazing stab of making an authentic James Bond film in Never Say Never Again, and it deserves to be celebrated more than it does. I hope that what our discussion has encouraged listeners to give it another look.
Mm. Yeah, certainly.
Mm. I mean, for me, one of the things that I found quite interesting, again, is trying to place them in their time as well, because Thunderball was Bond at its peak. They'd just done Goldfinger, which is arguably one of the best Bond films of all time. They were riding completely on a high point, so they're obviously going to be pushing it more and trying to sort of, you know, outdo itself, and you can see that in the lavish production, whereas, you know, Never Say Never Again, they were trying to chuck as much into it because they wanted to be a recognizable Bond film, but they had more, you know, there was a bit of financial trouble in the background of that film as well, to try and sort of get everything across the line. So in some respects, you've on one hand, you've got a film which is lavish because it's a franchise that knows it can blow out and probably suffers a little bit for it, actually, because there's some elements which sort of suffer when you inevitably get that point of bloating. Whereas on the other hand, you've got something which is, yes, it's trying to fit a lot in, but it's also having to be quite lean because it doesn't quite know where it's going to go in there. So I think for me, when you look at them in context, they're kind of fascinating. They add a lot more into it. But I would also agree that I think I would probably prefer to watch Never Say Never Again. Although, you know, I Thunderball's not a great Bond film, but it's not an awful one. It's entertaining. It's got a lot that's very enjoyable about it. And it's just, I think it just kind of, for want of a better word, it does jump the shark a little bit in Thunderball compared to Goldeneye. Not Goldeneye, sorry, Goldfinger.
Quite literally, in fact.
Yes, indeed. Literally. Watching Happy Days at the same time. I mean, I think we've largely covered what is probably one of the more interesting Bond films out there for many different reasons. If you were going to give a Jerry Springer style final thought to Never Say Never Again, what would it be?
I think this film has got better with time, actually. Not in its storytelling or in its production, because that has dated in some respects, but I think more in how it fits within the whole umbrella of the Bond universe. And I'm not talking about the cinematic universe, I'm talking about the whole thing. And I think this is where it was born, as a collaborative project between Fleming and McClory, and where it went. So there are aspects of this that have become Bond lore that were taken away, unusable for years and years through litigation, and then obviously been brought back in very, very recent times. So I think that looking back on this gives you a good understanding of where they went to when they rebooted Bond. And it gives you a sign that you can play around with Bond, with the concept of the 007 section, of the concept of M as well. And I think it's only with what's happened with the franchise since this film that you can see how important this has actually been within the whole sphere.
I like to think that if Cubby watched this movie and went, you know what, these guys, I'm seething with rage because these guys shouldn't be doing this film, but this movie is doing stuff that I probably can't do, and now is maybe making me think I can do those things. So I think you're right, Graham. I think to an extent it's set the franchise free and set the way for movies, maybe even like License to Kill, maybe when Tim Dalton came along, to sort of say, well, we can maybe, you know, change this up a little bit, change this around. And then indeed in 2006, which coincidentally is when they got back the rights for the this story, basically,
yeah,
and could get, you know, they said, well, we can do a franchise reboot, because they did it 20 years ago and it actually kind of worked. You know, yeah, the movie did well, and as long as it's done well and it's made with sincerity. And I think that that's probably, if you're looking for my Jerry Springer moment, and I've mentioned this before in previous podcasts, all of this falls to part if the filmmakers aren't taking it seriously.
Yeah.
Sincerity is key in any successful James Bond film, and this is a very sincerely made film, made by very, very talented and skilled filmmakers and performed by extremely talented and skilled actors. It has all the flaws of any 80s action film, but what it doesn't have is it doesn't have those really horrible, cringeworthy moments that a lot of James Bond films do have. That you look back on there as we examine and as our values have changed over the years, Never Say Never Again doesn't leave us sort of like thinking, ooh, that was a bit creepy.
My Jerry Springer moment is quite simply that Bond doesn't deal particularly well. He struggles with underwater climaxes.
Don't we all?
Well, speak for yourself.
Discipline, 007, discipline.
And then that bombshell. I've been holding this together since the first time Terry mentioned the phrase underwater climax about 10 minutes ago in the pod.
I didn't realise, yes, well done.
Yes. Kept my professionalism up to a point. And on that note,
also, can I just quickly point out that on this podcast, you did actually suggest that Sebastian Faulks is guilty of writing fan fiction. One of our nation's most celebrated literary geniuses is guilty of fan fiction, according to the Odd Job Pod, because we have to accept responsibility, collective responsibility for all opinions expressed on this.
We have to own our takes. Otherwise, someone else will.
Yeah.
I dread to think what Reddit forums Sebastian Faulks is playing for / Harry Potter fan fiction as Faulks. And that's gone down a route that I don't think anybody saw coming in there. Okay, well, I think we will call it an end to this particular Odd Job Pod. As ever, it has been a pleasure. The Odd Job Pod will, as ever, return again for more hot takes, for more historical look-backs, and for more dreadful fan fiction. And if Seb Faulks wants to join us for our next podcast, I'm sure he'd be very welcome to do a fan fiction. And we could get him in for a commentary. Imagine that. Odd Job Pod teaming up with Sebastian Faulks to do a commentary on The Rock.
If we can make it work.
Sign up to our new Patreon page and get this. All we need is £1 million.
$1 million.
$1 million.
Terry and Graham, thank you as ever. It's been a genuine pleasure, as always.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gary. It certainly has.
And thank you, dear listener. We hope that if you haven't seen Never Say Never Again, you will check it out. And we hope that you have better luck with the underwater climaxes than we do. Thank you very much. The Odd Job Pod will return. And please do go ahead and rate us on your podcast network of choice. Download, subscribe, look at our back catalogue. So you can look at our back catalogue, but it won't do any good. You should listen to it instead. And generally just spread the word. And thank you very much for listening. Thank you, Terry and Graham. Goodbye.
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 I am sorry for bringing that, lowering the tone right at the end.
I wouldn't be sorry if I were you. So what about we do an episode dedicated to Q next time?
Oh, nice one.
Yeah.
Ooh,
yeah.
I like that one.
Yeah. Yeah. So are we going all Q, or are we just going, we'll be going through all incarnations of Q, including John Cleese?
What do you think?
I mean, you can't not touch on John Cleese, even if it, you know, it's one of them. Two, he was Q's apprentice in.
Yeah, he was R, wasn't he? Yeah.
Not Enough, and then elevated to Q in Dynamite. That dreadful. film. I like that because that really gives me a chance to talk a lot about License to Kill.
Great. Cool. Okay, let's do Q next episode, and let's try and make it for sometime next month then.
Yes, sure.
Yeah? Yeah.